50 Years of Saving Lives, the book, narrated by Mike Fronczek.
We are continuing our reading from Wisconsin Right to Life's 50th anniversary book, 50 Years of Saving Lives, and now we have reached the beginning of Chapter 2, The 70s, subtitled Fallout, When the Womb Became a Kill Zone. Fallout. It's what human beings fear the most in the wake of a nuclear incident. For those poor people not vaporized at detonation, the slow cancerous demise caused by radioactive fallout is often what kills the unfortunate souls next closest to ground zero. In 1973, the United States Supreme Court responded to the liberalization fallout of the 60s and made the wombs of an entire nation ground zero for the unborn. There is an inset on the page where Chapter 2 begins, which reads from William Shakespeare's Macbeth, Act 1, Scene 4. Stars, hide your light, so no one can see the terrible desires within me. I won't let my eye look at what my hand is doing. But in the end, I'm still going to do that thing I'd be horrified to see. Troubled water. We Americans are a strange lot. We take a notion as unthinkably horrid as fallout and repurpose the word as an adjective to describe even the most casual, non-life-threatening situations. Take this Wall Street Journal headline, for example, quote, managing the fallout from working extra hours, end quote. Most of us are pretty sure there's nothing radioactive about overtime. But in terms of the sexual revolution ushered in by the 60s, fallout is a very accurate term. By the mid-70s, unborn baby deaths by abortion in America tipped over the 1 million mark annually. What makes that a particularly staggering statistic is that in 1965, a mere 10 years earlier, fewer than 800 abortions were performed nationally each year. Imagine that. Abortion deaths jump from under 1,000 a year to more than 1 million annually in just over a decade. Now that's fallout. The impact of the 60s darkened the 70s. Pop music affected and reflected the national mood. Songs like Edwin Starr's War, Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side, Deep Purple's Smoke on the Water, The Who, Won't Get Fooled Again, AC/DC's Highway to Hell, Iggy Pop, Lust for Life, Pink Floyd's Comfortably Numb, and Eric Burdon's Spill the Wine. And, of course, the iconic Simon and Garfunkel classic Bridge Over Troubled Water. And troubled waters they were. Bruce J. Schulman, in his 2001 work, The 70s, The Great Shift in American Culture, Society, and Politics, suggests there was a deep change underway in American politics and attitudes. The war in Vietnam, coupled with the Watergate scandal, which ultimately led to Richard Nixon's resignation, created even more skepticism toward government and a further rejection of traditional ideals. An inset on page 33 of 50 Years of Saving Lives reads this way. While conservatism toward government grew amongst the populace in the 1970s, social and cultural legacies from the 1960s became more mainstream. Most Americans, even Southerners, accepted the immorality of racial segregation and disenfranchisement. Long hair and outrageous clothing became the norm for Americans of all political and social backgrounds, while sexuality outside of traditional marriage became widely practiced and accepted, especially amongst the younger generation. Shulman contends that personal liberation and rebellion against authority became key themes of the 1970s, as Americans sought individualism through new outlooks on religion, popular culture, and sexuality. And that ends the Shulman quote on page 33. Murder at the Majestic. In the 70s, what was once abhorrent was beginning to be seen as acceptable. Attitudes about sex and abortion were relaxing. In Milwaukee, just before the dawn of the new decade, it was revealed that something tragic and illegal was going on in one of the units of the Majestic building at 231 West Wisconsin Avenue. A particular Wisconsin law was being broken, and this attracted the attention of local authorities. The impact of these events would stretch across the 70s and beyond. The man who stood accused of the crime was Dr. Sidney G. Babbitts. A former Wisconsinite, the physician had relocated to sunny Florida, but still made regular trips to Milwaukee to conduct a clandestine abortion business. When substantial evidence proved that Babbitts was performing abortions in violation of Wisconsin Statute 940-04, Babbitts was charged. He faced up to a $5,000 fine and/or 3 years imprisonment. Prosecution of the case fell to Milwaukee County District Attorney Mike McCann. Some may have thought McCann's action on the Babbitts case came out of bias, stemming especially out of his Catholic faith and devotion to right-to-life ideals. But during our personal interview, he was quick to clarify to me, quote, "I wasn't targeting the guy. It came to our attention he was performing abortions, so we investigated. The state statute was clear. There was evidence he was in violation, so we prosecuted." End quote. Longtime friend Michael Ash lauded McCann's sense of duty to being a straight shooter. Quote, "I think he perceives more strongly and more definitively than most people in our society that there is a right and a wrong, and that it's important to him to act on that perception." End quote. Sworn in as DA on January 1, 1969, McCann would be reelected again and again, serving an unprecedented 38 years. A number of actions bearing on right-to-life issues came through the DA's office during his long career, but none, perhaps, as meaningful to the cause of life as the Babbitts abortion case. Going back to the days when Mike McCann sat on the Archbishop's steering committee concerning the threats facing State Statute 940-04, he told us, quote, "The focus was on finding ways to ward off legislative challenges to our existing law. After all," McCann said, "that's what was happening in New York, so that's what we expected." End quote. Indeed, that's what the Archbishop and all those on the committee expected, that challenges would come from pro-abortion legislators to overturn or weaken Wisconsin's ban through the lawmaking process. But they were wrong. Right-to-life supporters were blindsided by a brand new pro-abortion tactic, and this new tactic wasn't pending legislation. No, this was a judicial attack, thrown squarely in DA Mike McCann's face. McCann woke up one morning to learn he was being sued in United States District Court by abortionist Dr. Sidney Babbitts. The tables had been turned. The prosecutor was now a defendant. The accused was now the plaintiff. And Wisconsin's ban on abortion was on trial for being, allegedly, in part, unconstitutional. Worse yet, when the dust had settled on the case, McCann had lost. Quote, "This three-judge court, comprised of Circuit Judge Otto Kerner and District Judges John Reynolds and Myron Gordon, heard Babbitts' lawsuit to stop enforcement of the state's abortion statute. Imagine, this is 1970, McCann told us. And, he said, several years before Roe v. Wade. and this three-judge panel issued a declaratory judgment, not an injunction, that Wisconsin's abortion law, 940-04, was, in part, unconstitutional. Unquote. Nearly 40 years later, discussing this case with me, Mike McKen was still clearly disturbed by the court's decision. Quote, "The way they worded their opinion really goes to the heart of the issue," he said. The court wrote, "When measured against the claimed, quote, rights, end quote, of an embryo of 4 months or less, we hold that the mother's right transcends that of such an embryo." So, you see, McKen explained to us, this court wouldn't see the rights of the embryo. To them, they were only claimed rights, not real rights. "I was really surprised," McKen said. "This is 3 years ahead of Roe v. Wade," end quote. What did this mean? Effectively, the court's declaratory judgment made it impossible for D.A. McKen to prosecute Babbitts for his crime, although he wanted to. McKen appealed the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court, but the effort was rejected on a technicality. The technicality is explained in the footnotes of our book, 50 Years of Saving Lives, Wisconsin Right to Life's 50th Anniversary Book, which we are reading and in the midst of Chapter 2. Wisconsin wasn't the only state where efforts were underway to liberalize abortion laws or challenge them in court. By 1970, pro-abortion supporters had pushed a total of 12 states to adopt so-called reforms to abortion laws, and 7 more would do so over the next 3 years. If pro-abortion forces learned anything by their court challenge victory in Wisconsin and elsewhere, it was to aim higher. If overturning abortion laws was this easy, why not go for the whole enchilada? Why not overturn every abortion law in the country in one fell swoop? Little more than 2 years later, they would do just that. On page 36 of Chapter 2 of 50 Years of Saving Lives, a newspaper article is reproduced from Wednesday, May 26, 1971, as published in the Stevens Point, Wisconsin Daily Journal. The journal writer, Stephen Rayner, with the Associated Press, was reporting on a hearing held in the state capitol with the headline, "State Abortion Hearing Packed." And the article begins this way. More than 700 persons jammed into the Wisconsin Assembly Chambers Tuesday to confront lawmakers with the emotional question of liberalized abortion laws. We've highlighted a particular set of paragraphs within this article, and these paragraphs read as follows. Milwaukee attorney Dennis Pertell, representing Wisconsin Citizens Concerned for the Unborn, which is what Wisconsin Right to Life was called in 1971, said liberalized abortion laws would lead to abortion clinics staffed by non-medical personnel. Abortionists, he asserted, will be moving into the shopping centers. Pertell said state laws recognize unborn children as enjoying a number of rights. These include the right to inherit, the right to sue, the right to receive blood transfusions despite the religious objections of parents, and the right to a court-appointed guardian, he argued. To give a pregnant mother the life or death responsibility of whether to carry a child, Pertell said, would be a violation of due process of law. And here ends our quotations from the Stevens Point Daily Journal from May 26, 1971. Beneath that reproduced article is the subheadline, "Strip Mall Death Traps." In the 70s, Wisconsin pro-abortion forces were not only at work in courtrooms, they were also, as expected, applying legislative pressure to weaken or repeal 940-04. In the newspaper article we just read from you from May of 1971, it is clear that passions were elevated on both sides. Particularly remarkable were the words of Milwaukee attorney Dennis Purtell, who was at the Madison Capitol Building hearing representing Wisconsin citizens concerned for life. As we mentioned, Purtell told the Assembly Judiciary Committee that liberalizing Wisconsin's abortion laws would lead to abortion clinics being staffed by non-medical personnel, and that one day they will be moving into the shopping centers. Well, sadly, both of Purtell's predictions have come true. Today, Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers position themselves in strip malls and other prominent places nearest to college campuses and in other neighborhoods where the poorest and most vulnerable women are likely to find them and fall into their death trap. Once inside, they find nearly all clinic workers wearing scrubs and stethoscopes, quote, to give the impression they can be trusted, end quote, even though they have no medical training. Norma McCorvey, also known as Jane Roe, the plaintiff in the Roe v. Wade decision, wrote, quote, because of the politics surrounding abortion and the unparalleled success of the abortion lobby, veterinary clinics have stricter regulations than abortion clinics, end quote. As recently as 2016, an investigation into clinic standards across the U.S. reported that the abortion industry is shady and largely unregulated. Quote, in addition to the discovery of unsafe conditions, there is an absence of protective laws in some states, a lack of accountability as far as regular state inspections, and public access to public health reports on the goings-on at these abortion facilities. On this page in the book 50 Years of Saving Lives, there is a photograph of Norma McCorvey with her birth year of 1947 and her death year of 2017. Beneath it, this brief few paragraphs about Norma McCorvey. As a young woman in a crisis pregnancy, Norma McCorvey agreed to work with Sarah Weddington, who led the legal team that brought a test case on abortion to the U.S. Supreme Court. Ironically, Norma never once had an abortion. For the sake of her privacy, as plaintiff in the case, Norma was identified simply as Jane Roe. The 1973 decision in Roe v. Wade ushered in legalized abortion on demand in the United States, overturning all state laws banning abortion, including Wisconsin's. Even though she remained part of the pro-choice side for years, even working in an abortion clinic, Norma suffered horrible emotional trauma, recognizing her role in the deaths of millions of unborn babies. Struggling to manage the guilt and shame she felt as Jane Roe, Norma lived a dysfunctional lifestyle, abusing alcohol and drugs to numb the pain. Ultimately, she became a Christian and turned her back on Jane Roe. Later, Norma recognized she had been used as a pawn in a much larger game. She wrote, quote, Jane Roe was all that mattered to Sarah Weddington. Norma McCorvey was irrelevant. And at the bottom of page 37, we read this pull quote from Norma McCorvey. Quote, I think it's safe to say that the entire abortion industry is based on a lie. I am dedicated to spending the rest of my life undoing the law that bears my name. At the top of page 38 appears this headline from an article reproduced from the Monroe, Wisconsin Evening Times, dated January 22nd, 1973. The headline, High Court Strikes Down Abortion Laws. Washington, Associated Press. The Supreme Court today barred the states from interfering with the decision of a woman and her doctor to end pregnancies within the first 3 months. In the 7-2 decision striking down the Texas abortion law, Justice Harry A. Blackmun said medical data indicates abortion in the first 3 months, quote, although not without its risks, is now relatively safe, end quote. Thereafter, he said, quote, any interest of the state in protecting the woman from an inherently hazardous procedure has largely disappeared, end quote. The Texas law made it a crime to end a pregnancy except, quote, for the purpose of saving the life of the mother, end quote. The ruling followed 2 years of deliberations by the justices. It was based predominantly on what Blackmun called a right of privacy. He said the right is, quote, broad enough to encompass a woman's decision whether or not to terminate her pregnancy, end quote. Justices Byron R. White and William H. Rehnquist dissented. White said he could find nothing in the language or history of the Constitution to support the court's judgment. Rehnquist, meanwhile, said, quote, the court's sweeping invalidation of any restrictions on abortion during the first trimester is impossible to justify, end quote. Blackmun's opinion rejected the theory pressed by abortion foes that a fetus is, quote, a person, end quote, within the constitutional terms and must be protected by the state. He said that in the Constitution, quote, use of the word is such that it has application only postnatally, end quote. In a second 7-2 ruling, the court struck down Georgia's abortion law, finding 3 provisions to be unconstitutional. They were that in the first 3 months the operation be performed in an accredited hospital, that a medical committee must give its approval, and that 2 physicians must concur with the woman's own physician that the pregnancy should be terminated. Blackmun said, quote, the interposition of a hospital abortion committee is unduly restrictive of the patient's rights, end quote. Blackmun added, we need not resolve the difficult question of when life begins. When those trained in the respective disciplines of medicine, philosophy, and theology are unable to arrive at any consensus, the judiciary at this point in the development of man's knowledge is not in a position to speculate as to the answers. End quote. And here ends the reading of the Associated Press story appearing in the Monroe, Wisconsin Evening Times from January 22, 1973, reporting on the Supreme Court's tragic Roe v. Wade decision. Subtitled beneath that article is Roe v. Wade. The January 22, 1973 Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton decisions legalized abortion in the United States for the full 9 months of pregnancy. Prior to 1967, abortion was prohibited in all 50 states except when the mother's life was in danger. Between 1967 and 1973, 18 states added further exceptions, mostly to allow abortion in cases of rape and incest, or for certain limited medical reasons, or on demand, for example, as New York's law was amended. In 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court rendered 2 decisions, Roe v. Wade, 410 U.S. 113, and Doe v. Bolton, 410 U.S. 179, which, when implemented together, have allowed legal abortion on demand at any stage of pregnancy in all 50 states. The 2 original decisions established legal abortion as follows. 1. In the first 3 months of pregnancy, no one can interfere with a woman's decision to abort her child. 2. After the first 3 months, but before the, quote, viability, end quote, of the unborn child, an individual state can enact laws to protect the health of the mother, but cannot prohibit the abortion of the unborn child. 3. After viability of the unborn child, an individual state can, if it chooses to do so, enact laws to protect the unborn child, but abortion must be allowed if the life or health of the mother is at stake. The Supreme Court defined health very broadly as the, quote, medical judgment that may be exercised in light of all factors, physical, emotional, psychological, familial, and the woman's age, relevant to the well-being of the patient. All these factors may relate to health, end quote. Consequently, this expansive definition of health has made abortion legal up to the moment of birth. And here ends part one of our reading of chapter two from the Wisconsin Right to Life anniversary book, 50 Years of Saving Lives.